Welcome. It is Your Money. I'm Susie Jones, reminding you right out of the gate. If you have a financial question for Peg or Bruce, you can call this number 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The number is 1-888-6-ADVICE. You can also email your question to yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. Right now, though, you can call or text our studio line at 651-461-9226. Now here is Wealth Enhancement Group Senior Vice President and Financial Advisor Peg Webb and the founder of Wealth Enhancement Group and Financial Advisor Bruce Helmer. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning, Susie. Good morning, Bruce.
Hi, Peg. Hello, Susie Jones and listeners. And I hope everybody remembered to spring ahead today. Peg, I got to tell you, I don't know about you, but this is the one show every year that the night before I'm most stressed out about. I freak out that I'm going to oversleep and forget to spring ahead and be late for the show. But I think we're on time.
Yeah, my alarm was set for 6 a.m., which is the old 5 a.m., and so I went, well, I am tired, you know, but got up anyway, and so a couple more cups of coffee today.
Yeah, well, we lost an hour, and I'll pick that up maybe later today with a nap. Hey, Peg, we have, an interesting topic today, but before we jump into it, one of the things I hear sometimes from listeners is that we don't take enough listeners' questions, and Susie just mentioned wealthenhancement.com, and you can email questions. We have a couple of pretty good ones, I think, that we want to start with and get to right away from a listener. And I have to confess before I read it that when I read it, I didn't know the answer off the top of my head, but I think you were kind enough to do some research for us. But let me just read it, and I'll let you talk about it. The questions, can we talk about safe harbor IRAs and why most people should avoid them after they leave their jobs? I searched Google and found only three articles, and then below the top three results are safe harbor 401k rules. I think Bruce and Peg should bring this up as often as they bring up why people shouldn't have panicked in 2008 and 2009. And then the same person adds, also, can you discuss automatic portability as it relates to what the Retirement Clearinghouse did about 2 years ago in provisions in Secure Act 2.0 on portability? So, Peg, safe harbor and portability. What does that mean?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because I haven't really heard safe harbor in a long time, although I absolutely have participated in safe harbor 401ks. And so I had to do a little bit of research, so I thank the emailer for sending it during the week. But just safe harbor alone is a retirement plan. So as we are employees of our company is going to pick some type of retirement plan, 401k, 403b, that kind of thing. In my research, though, I was just amazed. You know how every May we get these 5500s, and it's a form that the IRS gets every year about all these retirement plans that are out there. So there's actually 86.6 million plans. I mean, these numbers are just staggering to me. That's why I wanted to talk about them today. And then there's $9.3 trillion in assets. Well, no wonder there's this organization that oversees all this, you know, the government, the Employee Benefits Security Information Group, which is good in that they're trying to have everything in the best interest of the employee, right? So these safe harbor plans have been out since 2001. This is nothing new, nothing. It just, in 2001, gave the sponsors of these retirement plans the authority to just automatically terminate your plan if it was $5,000 or under when you leave or you lost your job there. And why would they do that? Well, just the maintenance of, you know, taking care of those smaller plans. Now, think about it. 2001, $5,000 was really a lot more money than it is today. But so they had to come up with some way of saying, okay, this is so small. Now, what I didn't realize, Bruce, is that there's so many dormant plans out there where a lot of them are these defined benefit plans, contribution plans, where the employer actually puts money in. So a lot of times the employee doesn't even know that there's a balance, or, you know, they just don't have the wherewithal to know that it's out there. So there's this huge number of uncashed checks, because what these sponsors would do is they would just mail out these checks. And people had moved, and now there's so many uncashed checks. Well, how it relates today, though, and why the emailer asked the question was because we talk a lot about the Secure Act 2.0. And when that happened last fall, it gave sponsors an option to automatically terminate this participation in these small accounts, but they raised it $7,000 now instead of $5,000. The real negative here is when you move to these safe harbor IRAs, there was some lesser fiduciary responsibility on those benefit administrators. So what they did is they put that money in a money market or something that was super safe. So the negative to that is people out there don't know they have it. And then a negative is you're not really earning anything, and especially like the last 10 years when cash or money markets were paying nothing. So they want to change that, Bruce. They just want to add, some awareness of these plans. They've got new services out there to try to search for these people. So that's actually a really good thing. This auto portability, which is kind of the second question, is just a way for employee savings plans to go to their next employer. So what's happening today that really didn't happen a lot in the past is that people are switching jobs, and they might have two jobs in 1 year, and to have all these, you know, smaller plans out there because they keep changing jobs, it's hard, you know, for the consumer to be aware of what's all out there. So this portability is going to help get those 401ks into the new employer quicker and have a better streamlined process, Bruce.
Peg, that was a really excellent answer. And I have to confess, I was vaguely aware of these issues on my peripheral vision, but I really didn't know the detail. On occasion, I will come across someone that has a retirement plan or finds out about one that they didn't know they had, like you just described. But apparently it's more prevalent than I realize, because I've only seen it a couple of times in my practice. But I think that's the big takeaway, because at the end of the day, the options for investors out there, there's always four options from a captive retirement plan, right? You might be able to leave it in your old plan when you separate service if you want to. Number two, you might be able to, thus this portability discussion, you might be able to move it to your new plan if you go to a different job. Number three is you can withdraw the money and pay the taxes on it. And number four is you can convert it or transfer it to an individual retirement account. So those are the only four options, and they've always been the only four options. But how do you know how to take action on one of those four things if you have money that you don't realize you have? So I think that's right. Really the key takeaway.
Right. And then, you know, a lot of times, too, when accounts are that small, people just automatically cash them out. Oh, I wouldn't do that, right? Just truly trying to have people save for their retirement and not cash them out. And now, once again, with changing job a lot, and I think this now jumps into the topic for today, Bruce, because I think this is a big deal where now with, gig workers and that, why don't you set up the show? Because I think it really ties in well with the topic we have today.
Yeah, it's a perfect segue, and that's part of the reason why we wanted to talk about that. So, listeners, and Susie, today we're going to talk about planning and retirement for non-traditional careers. Peg mentioned gig workers, and this is a phenomenon, Peg, that I won't say the pandemic caused it, but the pandemic certainly helped explode it. I mean, we were starting to see DoorDash and these sort of gig jobs, these side gigs, were starting before the pandemic, but the pandemic really increased how many people have these sort of non-traditional jobs. And so we thought we'd talk a little bit today about some of the challenges of that type of work, and maybe some of the benefits and some of the reasons it's attractive to people, but how you're planning and your financial planning and retirement planning, some of the unique challenges to these non-traditional jobs. Peg?
Yeah, what's interesting is kind of, you know, these jobs are self-employment. And so we've worked with self-employed people our entire career. But when you're thinking about doing these jobs, it isn't like you're trying to build a big company, right? Like self-employed people used to be, in my mind, they're starting a business to grow the business super large, right? Or that you're growing a business and you want to have a few employees. Well, anytime you're self-employed, that adds tremendous complexity on, you know, gathering your wages and following these IRS rules. When I just talked about this rule today that's changing, there's 1,000 rules behind that really self-employed people should know, or they have to hire a professional to be able to help them with their books or help them with retirement. So today we're going to talk more about the retirement part, because we worry that if you now are, you have a business for dog walking, or you've got the TaskRabbit where you do all these handyman things, or the Instacart. Boy, do I use Instacart. I mean, today, the fact that, and I thought, oh, well, do you work for them? Oh, no, I'm a self-employed person. I ask questions when they come, because it's interesting to know, how are you building your future in savings? So, yes. This gig thing gives more flexibility. You know, the problem is there's really no job security per se. There's no daily routine. And actually, Bruce, I have to confess, I am such a focus-driven person that I kind of admire people who can, you know, for 2 hours be doing this and then just jump into their job and then go back there. You know, they have a 2-hour gig and then they go, you know, they're jumping back and forth. Now, a lot of these gigs and these people who are self-employed don't have the health care coverage, the retirement plan, all those kinds of things. So today we just kind of wanted to talk a little bit, Bruce, about, you know, how challenging that is for these people, and maybe they can learn something while we walk through the outline. Bruce?
Yeah, and the only other comment I would make, and that's a really good introduction to what we're going to dive a little deeper on, Peg, but think about how normal all this is now, and it wasn't so very long ago. We didn't have any of these things. I mean, remember a time before Uber and Lyft, and remember a time before Instacart? I mean, these are things that I use all the time now, and I just take them for granted, but it wasn't so very long ago. They didn't exist, and now I can't remember what life was like without them. So there's a lot of these jobs out there. It's very diversified, the different things that people do for side gigs. You know, you mentioned some of them, dog walking, pet babysitting, and handyman, and so forth. So very different career, very different set of issues in terms of how do you take this income and how do you put money aside and be able to retire someday. And so that's what we want to take a little bit of a deeper dive on, Peg.
Well, I've said a million times on this show, how do you hide money from yourself? And a way to hide money from yourself is the traditional way. You know, if you work for someone and you're an employee, then you have the option, and sometimes you don't have an option, they'll take out at least 3% out of your paycheck before you have any net dollars go to your checking account. I think that's a wonderful, beautiful thing, because human behavior is, if you have access to your money, then it's likely that you have a high probability that you may spend it. So I find that is kind of a challenge for all these new self-employed people. And then you can, and we also encourage people to do that. If you were fully funding your 401k, but now you're self-employed, maybe you want some kind of an automatic distribution out of your checking, like right away. You know, you have to create a financial plan, you know how much you can put in. That's where your tax accountant comes in, or if you self-prepare, you should be aware of that. And even, you know, a lot of these jobs don't pay as much, right? And so, you know, people will say to me, well, I don't have any extra to save. But we have to go back to square one, where we used to encourage people, and especially young people, why not put $25, $50, $100, hide that from yourself? And it's amazing over time, you know, how proud you'd be of yourself of doing that. The other thing, before I hand it to you, Bruce, is all these benefits we kind of get, these credits that we get, like qualifying for Social Security. So they take money out of our paycheck, you know, to fund security. Not that these people that are self-employed don't have to participate and pay into it, but it's not as traditional. That's what we're talking about. And Medicare credits, make sure that you get your, you know, your years in, that you qualify for Social Security and that you understand Medicare. Now, Bruce, lastly, I would say there's clients of ours that have already retired. So they had all the traditional things, but now they have this self-employment and they're learning along with others. As when you're an employee, it's almost easier than when you're self-employed. Bruce?
Well, you just hit on a key point that I was actually thinking about. So clearly these side hustles or these gig, this non-traditional job culture exists. We all see it. But I don't know if there's numbers on. I know a lot of them are people that maybe already retired from their quote unquote real job, their old 40-hour week job, and they're doing this for extra retirement income. I'm sure some people still have a quote unquote real 40-hour week job, and this is a side gig. And then there's a lot of people that this has become their main job, their full-time gig. They do it all day, every day. And those circumstances in terms of saving money or investing money or having to contribute to FICA and Medicare, it's going to be different for all those. So we've got about 3 minutes before we need to take a break. What's some of the key things in terms of listeners out there that this applies to that we want to make sure that we convey here in the first half of the show? Peg?
Yeah, so some of the tools we use are at Wealth Enhancement Group is solo 401k. So if you're all by yourself, you should check that out because it is designed for self-employed individuals and independent contractors, people like that, and that people who, you know, own or work with their spouse who have no employees. As your employer, you may already have some contributions that you could contribute. You have traditional IRAs. We talk a lot about those, Bruce, and Roth IRAs. You still have all that accessible to you. And then lastly, health savings accounts. I think this is a big deal, and people aren't as aware of maybe a health savings account that you can set up on your own as a self-employed person. So those are the things that we even tell our clients to look into if they have some extra monies, you know, beyond what they're earning to save for the future.
Yeah, and you kind of led it into this, Peg. Even though the amount of these side gigs or this non-traditional jobs has expanded, self-employed people have been around forever. So the planning opportunities, it's not new to Wealth Enhancement. We've seen this before. We're just seeing it a lot more frequently now. And I think one of the key things you also hit on at the very beginning, Peg, is it's so easy to save and invest when you're a captive employee of a big company with a retirement plan. They just withhold from your paycheck. They maybe provide a matching contribution. And it's just easy, right? You don't miss the money. You live on the paycheck you get after you make your contributions. But now if you're responsible for making those contributions, it gets a lot harder. It gets a lot trickier. A lot of the same tools, solo 401k, IRA, Roth IRA, health savings account, they're still available, but you have to be more proactive. And I think you, the other key thing, Peg, you said earlier, is figure out a way to set it up on some sort of automatic system so you don't have to physically manually do it every month. Because if that's the case, there's a lot of months that you won't do it. We just know that. It's human behavior. So I think maybe that's the key takeaway. Then, Susie, second half of the show, maybe we'll hit on a couple of other things surrounding this issue. And again, it affects a lot of people. And maybe listeners want to ask a question, or maybe listeners that have a gig job want to share their own experiences of some hints or things that they do. But we'll definitely get listeners involved in the second half.
All right.
Susie?
Yeah, Bruce, they're very good. 651-461-9226 is the number to call if you have a question for Bruce or Peg. 651-461-9226. And remember, any time you can email your questions if you're listening right now and you want to get to it later, yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you can call this number, 1-888-6-ADVICE. Again, 1-888-6-ADVICE. But for the next half hour, it's all yours, 651-461-9226. And welcome back to the second half of Your Money. If you have a financial question for Bruce or Peg, you can call this number 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The number 1-888-6-ADVICE. And you can always email questions to yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. But for the next 25 minutes, you can text 651-461-9226 to ask a question of Bruce or Peg. You can also use that number, 651-461-9226, to call and be a part of the show. Now, once again, Wealth Enhancement Group Senior Advisor and Senior Vice President and Financial Advisor Peg Webb, and Founder of Wealth Enhancement Group and Financial Advisor Bruce Helmer. Welcome back to both of you. We've got Linda on the line and a number of text questions, so take it away.
Thank you, Susie Jones. I'll just quickly recap. Peg and I have been talking about non-traditional careers, so-called gig side hustles, and retirement planning, financial planning. And I think just the key takeaway is, Peg, it's discipline. It's not as easy to do the things that you would normally do in a traditional job on these gigs, and you just have to have self-discipline and be proactive. I think that's the key takeaway. And as we answer questions here from listeners in the second half of the show, maybe we'll dive into some of this again inadvertently, because we do want to hear from listeners that have a side gig, positives, negatives, your own experiences, how you go about saving, if it's a tip you want to share. But Susie, let's get to Linda and the texters, and let's let listeners drive the second half of the show.
All right, very good. Linda is on the news line from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Good morning, Linda. Thanks for popping on with us.
Good morning. Yes, I'm actually from Woodbury, Minnesota. But I want to ask a couple questions if there's time. One is, I have a cousin who's got about $250,000 set up in an investment company, and then he's got his home. What would be a good allocation for an 81-year-old man to invest in, percentage-wise?
Linda, why don't you ask the second question, too, and then we'll kind of take both of them at once, if that's okay.
Okay, then the next question is it good to open a Roth IRA at 81 years old, pay the taxes now, or should he just remain at whatever recommendations for these allocations would be? And I can hang up and I'll listen.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you, Linda. Great questions. And I got to tell you, even though you're actually from Woodbury, not Milwaukee, you sent me kind of spiraling down the memory lane there. One of my jobs before starting Wealth Enhancement, I was with a bank out of Milwaukee, and I used to go to Milwaukee once a month for meetings. And I really had an affection for Milwaukee, and you made me think of that, or somebody made me think of that. But Peg, Linda's actually in Woodbury, and it sounds like she's asking questions on behalf of someone else, maybe an 81-year-old with, I think she said, $200,000 to $250,000 in investments, and they own their home. And what's a good asset allocation for an 81-year-old? And should they be considering contributions to a Roth IRA?
Yes. And an 81-year-old today is like a 70-year-old, you know, from yesteryear. So we ask a lot of questions because if, you know, it's kind of, well, what do you want to do with this money? I mean, is your goal to leave it to someone? Is your goal to still take future vacations? Are you worried about healthcare costs and maybe long-term care, what that would cost? Because the question is, should I buy stocks, bonds, real estate, or cash, kind of? What should I do with this money? Well, I think it's probably, for most of the clients that we work with, it's a combination of all of those things I said. You know, short-term savings, maybe some medium-term treasuries or CDs, or maybe it's, you know, still participating in the stock market because you feel like you're not going to spend that whole $250,000 in your lifetime, but you want to leave a legacy for someone, and maybe they're a lot younger than you and you want to grow some of that. So it seems like it might be a simple answer, but it's not, because Bruce, you always say everybody's a snowflake. And until we, you know, find out the uniqueness about you, we won't be able to recommend something. But generally, I would say short, medium, long holdings. And then this incorporates the Roth IRA. And then how do you put it in a taxable account? Should you try to shelter money? Maybe you're still working, because to contribute to an IRA or a Roth IRA, traditional or a Roth, you have to have earned income. So if you have earned income and you want to do that, that may not be a bad idea to participate in a Roth IRA, especially if you're not in a super high tax bracket at this point in time. So depending on your current circumstances, that's when we would suggest, oh, maybe you should do a traditional IRA and get the deduction. Maybe you should do a Roth IRA because you're in a low tax bracket. Maybe you can't do it at all, because you don't have earned income, as I described, because you need that to qualify. Bruce?
Peg, that's such an excellent answer. At first, I was thinking there was nothing I could add. But it does occur to me, you know, I knew you would say that you have to have earned income to be able to contribute. And if the person's 81, my thought was, well, they probably don't have earned income. But that, you're right. Today's 81 is yesteryear's 70 or 65. I mean, think about it. The two presidential candidates for the two major parties, both of them, whichever one gets elected, will be in their 80s before they get to the end of the four-year term. So the idea that there's no earned income may not be true. So, yes, if this person has earned income, they're eligible. Peg, I think a lot of people think that you're phased out of being able to contribute to IRAs and Roth IRAs once you hit required minimum distribution. But you could actually be in RMD and still contributing if you're still working and you still have earned income. So it was a really good question, and you gave a really good answer. And the other part of your answer that's so good, I think Linda wanted something, you know, kind of specific for this 81-year-old person. But you're right. Without knowing more about them, we can't be more precise. But again, in general terms, the answer is probably a little bit of all the things Peg said, right? Some stocks, some bonds, some cash, maybe some gold and silver and other precious metals. But how much in each one is going to depend upon that individual? What's the time horizon? What's the goal of the money? How much do you need for income, legacy planning, paying for health care? But the short answer is, when we look at our clients, we determine what kind of rate of return we think we need to achieve on their investments for them to achieve their goals and dreams, whatever they are. And again, we're all snowflakes. Everybody's different. Two people are exactly the same. But once we know the goals and objectives, we can back into the return on investment that we need to get for them to achieve those goals. And then we devise portfolios or investment strategies that we think can achieve those returns with the least amount of risk possible. So, Linda, there is a specific answer there, probably. We just don't know enough about the 81-year-old to be more precise. But I think diversification, as Peg mentioned and explained so well, is probably the real key there. Susie?
All right, 651-461-9226. This texter writes, I have some matured EE bonds, double E bonds. Is there any U.S. Treasury investment these funds could be transferred to delay paying taxes?
Peg, double E's and deferring taxes.
Yes. And so double E bonds are issued by the U.S. government. You can buy them at Treasury Direct, and they're 30-year bonds. Now, a lot of people that I know are not necessarily investing in EE bonds, 30-year bonds, although, you know, they actually, you don't get a penalty if you hold a 30-year bond for 5 years. If you cash it in 5 years or less, you're going to lose 3 months worth of interest. So what I am suggesting to people today is buying the actual treasuries. Now, in this case, I know the real question here was, can I actually, you know, put, let's give an example. If I put $10,000 in an EE bond and now it's worth 20. So now 10,000 of that, all that growth, which you have deferred all these years, is subject to ordinary income tax, not capital gains. It's ordinary income tax. So what happens is you would have to cash that in, gather the whole 20,000, pay some to the IRS, and then you could reinvest it to treasuries or money market at today's rates. So sorry to disappoint you, but there is going to be some tax that's going to have to be paid before you go buy something else. So let me just tell you one other thing. I've got clients where the EE bonds have already matured, and they're not paying interest anymore, but they're trying to strategically, and actually with our advice, strategically cash them out, maybe not in a lump sum, but maybe over a couple of years, so that you don't raise your income tax bracket by cashing out those EE bonds all in 1 year. Bruce?
Peg, that was an excellent answer. I would ask you just to clarify one thing. You made a point of emphasizing that the tax is ordinary income tax, not long-term capital gains. For listeners that might not understand the difference, can you clarify that?
Well, ordinary income tax means you will fall in your tax bracket. And that's what let's say you have ordinary income, you've got interest and dividends. Maybe you have a part-time job, you know, that you have income coming in. If you cash out that 20,000 EE bonds, it will be $10,000 taxed just like your ordinary income, you know, and that's a higher rate. And then if you're in a state like Minnesota, you're also going to get taxed on that Minnesota rate. Bruce?
Yeah, the difference, and again, it depends upon your total other income, but the difference between ordinary income tax and long-term capital gains, you know, you might be in a 22 or 24% federal tax bracket, and you might be able to pay long-term gains at 15% or less. So it is significant, and I'm glad you drew the distinction between ordinary income and long-term capital gains. And people might be familiar with this concept in that investments that are not inside of tax shelters, like traditional 401k plans or traditional IRAs, they might be able to get long-term capital gains treatment on their gains. But on IRAs and 401ks and any type of tax-deferred plan, the taxes are always going to be ordinary income taxes. So, again, I'm glad you stressed that. I just wanted to make sure people understood the difference. Susie?
All right, 651-461-9226. This texter writes, help! I turned 73 in mid-February. When do I have to take RMD distribution, and how do I calculate the amount?
Thank you, Susie. So first of all, Peg, it's a great question. Turned 73 in February. When do they have to take required minimum distribution, and how do they calculate that? And I know you're going to give the answer, but before you do, I just want to say they probably should not try to do this all by themselves, right? Get some help. And maybe that's why they sent the text. But I mean, see somebody, see an accountant, see a financial advisor. But Peg, how do we go about doing that for people?
Yeah, what I would start with is the required minimum distribution has changed, and now it's been pushed out to 73. So let's say you turn 73 this year in 2024. You have a choice of, withdrawing your required minimum distribution this year, or you can wait until April 1st of next year. But the problem is if you wait till 2025, you will end up taking two required minimum distributions in 1 year. I still like the fact that that provision is out there because there's clients that are still working some of the year and they didn't want to put that extra required minimum distribution on a working year versus pushing it out for 2 years. So one of the things that that the custodians do is they typically would send you what the required minimum distribution number is on your statement. Now, here's the problem with that. Most people don't want their statements in the mail anymore, but the statements are still on the custodian website. And so it's not going to show like on the front page of the website. That just gives you all the numbers. But if you do a search for your statements, you literally can look at your monthly statement, and most custodians, once again, will have that number on there. The other thing is a lot of people don't necessarily have all their IRAs at the same custodian. So you'd have to repeat that process on looking for that required minimum distribution on each individual custodian, because then you need to tally them all up. But the good news is you can decide if you want to take all of that required minimum distribution from one of your custodians, or you want to take out the individual required minimum distribution out of all of them. So the other thing I would add is most people, if they work with a financial advisor, you can contact them. So at Wealth Enhancement Group, our clients will call. Some people will call in the very beginning of the year because they want to use that money as their cash flow. The numbers should be available. Usually are 10 days into the new year for us to notify clients, or if they call in, we've got the exact numbers that they need. Bruce?
Yeah, the only thing I would add is, and when I said that you shouldn't do this yourself, I guess if you have one IRA with one custodian, it's not going to be that complicated. But in my experience, Peg, and you alluded to this, a lot of people have multiple IRAs at different custodians. And so if you have to figure out your RMD from each one, it can get tricky. So and Peg mentioned this, what we do is we look at all of your IRAs at Wealth Enhancement, and we give you, and you have to add them all together to determine your total RMD, but you don't have to take withdrawals from all the accounts. So if you have five IRAs, we have to add them all together, but we might say, let's take that withdrawal from just one of them and leave four of them alone. The other thing to mention, Peg, is the calculation is based on the December 31st value the year prior to the year that you're going to take that distribution. So the texter, if they turned 73 in February of 24, and they're going to take an RMD in 24, that required minimum distribution amount is based on the December 31st value. It doesn't matter what happens to the account in January and February and later on until they take the withdrawal. It's based on a fixed number on December 31st. So sometimes people will ask me, the first week of January, what's my RMD that's going to be this year? And we don't know yet because we haven't seen the December 31st number yet. But then in terms of how much that RMD is, just roughly, again, we'll do a specific calculation, but at age 73, it's going to be about 4%. So if you have $100,000 in an IRA, you're going to have to take a withdrawal of roughly $4,000. Susie, do we have time to squeeze in one more question?
I think so. This is a good one. This texter writes, I converted $36,000 from my IRA to a Roth IRA in 2019. I am 68 years old. Can I take that money out tax-free today? I'm worried about the five-year rule.
Thanks. So, Peg, as some of our listeners know, Roth IRA, to get tax-free treatment, the money has to be there for 5 years or until age 59 and a half, whichever is longer. And it sounds like this texter did a conversion in 2019, and they want to know if they've hit the 5 years and if it's safe to take a tax-free withdrawal from their Roth.
Well, it kind of sounds like we're close, right, if it's 2019 and 2024. And it matters that you did the conversion all at one time. So I would, make sure you either talk to your financial advisor or you could talk to your CPA. But you would want to know if it's going to be tax-free. I mean, you wouldn't want to miss it by 30 days or something like that. The other thing you have to know is a conversion is the rules are a little bit different, and I can't quote them, versus your deposits into Roth IRAs on an annual basis. So the five-year rule does apply, but in some cases, you're going to want to review all the details of where that money came from, the time frame, and then go from there. Bruce?
And the other thing I think of, Peg, and the only reason I think of this is because I had a question from a client this week. So this texter did the conversion in 2019, so that's when they would have recognized the taxes for that conversion on their 2019 tax return. But I had a client ask me in this last week, they said, hey, I'm in a low tax bracket, I'm in a 12% bracket. I was thinking of converting $100,000 from traditional IRA to Roth IRA. Well, if you convert that much, you're not going to be in a 12% tax bracket anymore because you're adding $100,000 of income. You're probably going to jump up into a 22% bracket. So one of the things we do when we work with clients and we look at conversions, we determine, number one, is it efficient or smart to do a conversion? But number two, how much should we do? Because sometimes you can do too much in 1 year, and then there's also ripple effects like Medicare Part B premium and so on. So, but to the texter's question, yeah, it sounds like you've made your 5 years or you're close, but like Peg said, make darn sure, because you'd hate to miss it by a week or two and end up paying taxes when you wouldn't have to if you just wait and make sure you hit the 5 years. Susie, I know we don't have time for any more questions, but a lot of good ones today. Good show. Good questions from listeners. Thank you.
Yeah, and to listeners that are writing in, I know we have about less than a minute of the show, that they can email those questions right to you guys at yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com, and you get those over the week and perhaps come back next week with some answers. Is that right, you guys?
Absolutely.
Okay. Absolutely.
Good.
Yep.
Good. So yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com. If people did not get their question answered, you can also call 1-888-6-ADVICE. Make it a great week, everyone. It is Your Money. Again, that number to call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 1-888-6-ADVICE or yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com.